තෙරුවන් සරණයි. සයිරම්. How is everyone feeling today? I'm feeling much better than I was last week. Thanks to your blessings and your well wishes. I always believe that that can do much more than what a doctor can do. These two things, when they come together, medicine that heals the body and your well wishes and blessings that can do magic, this is always the perfect combination. So I'm feeling much better this week, with lots of thanks to all of you. I have a letter to read to you, but before I do that, this precept. And formally commence today's sermon.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
You know, I always take the time to remind you the value of this community. Sangha doesn't always come in a rope, and Sangha has nothing to do with the rope. There is a conventional Sangha, the conventional monks and the monastic order, which has to adhere to a code of conduct, bear robes, shaven head, and all that. It is to them the 227 rules apply. But Sangha is not only the monks and nuns that you see donned in robes. It is also the upasakas and the upasikas. And that's all of you. Together we form the community of the Sangha. Without you, there would be no us. And without us, there would be no you. Do you understand that? And do you agree with me on that? Where was I before I got here? Amongst you. So then without you, there would be no me. But why are you here now? Because there is us. So that is that beautiful relationship that the Sangha fosters and nurtures. Although we are different in the way that we dress ourselves, in our purpose we are united. So in that regard, I never look down at you. I never think that we are monks and you are lay people. That thought would be very lay. I don't think like that. There is always an open-hearted and a very warm and welcoming invitation to all of you. Not necessarily to come into robes. That is not my invitation. It's to make it easier on yourselves to get to Nibbana. That is the invitation always. To the extent, ladies and gentlemen, that if it were easier for you to get to Nibbana while you're there, then don't come here. Honestly. If it's easier for you to get to Nibbana while you're there, then do not come here. Do not come into robes. I have chosen this lifestyle, this livelihood, because it fast-tracks my Nibbana, because it accelerates my journey, because of the noble companionship that I am gifted and that comes with the robe, because you know why we are monks, and therefore no one comes and invites me to their parties anymore. No one comes and invites me to their birthdays anymore. No one invites me to go on a trip anymore. None of those things. No late night discourse. I mean, we have late night discourses, but no discourse. So it is to ensure that I have an environment around me that is always conducive to my Nibbana, I have chosen this lifestyle. So Nibbana comes first, lifestyle comes supplementary to that. It's secondary. I have with me a letter that I want to read out to you. This letter has been lovingly written by, well, I'll let you figure it out. Let me read it to you first. Ready? Right. Theruvan Saranai family, that's how it starts. It was an absolute pleasure to see you in such large numbers at the memorable occasion of laying the foundation stone for a space that will bring the world home. We are deeply grateful to have had the opportunity to make determinations alongside you and soon to teach alongside you and guide many children, including yours, towards unconditional happiness. We do not doubt that they will then go on to heal hearts and mend minds across the world. Waiting to see you all was like waiting to see family. We could clearly see the love, respect, and devotion in your eyes and across your faces when you saw us and worshipped us. This truly is the most wonderful community. Any guesses? Okay, let's see. Let's see whether you're right. So I can still see a few blank faces. My cousin from the States? Many of you have been inquiring about how we are, and I felt that these moments since receiving our Patkade, okay, now that limits it to who it can be. So the Patkade is a prayer mat that we tend to wear on our shoulders or carry in our hands. It's those ones there. Yeah, we call them prayer mats or Patkade. And I felt that these few moments since receiving our Patkade were an opportune time to share my thoughts with those who have been integral in us being Anagarika today. The cat's out the bag. Okay. With Theruvan Saranai, Pinsiddha Venava, and Samavenna being the three most heard phrases. The Anagarika Ramaya is a place like no other. With over 150 strong women working behind the greatest teachings towards one single goal. It is like a city that never sleeps. At any given moment, the Anagarika Ramaya is a pinkatayutu galore. So pinkatayutu is merit activities. A hive of activity. Some are making arms for the Mahasangha. Some are constructing new buildings for those who wish to join us. Some are engaged in gardening, cleaning, and building, while others are sewing robes for the Mahasangha. With Arya Maitri Sajjana in one corner and the Buddhaguna Sajjana in another, daily Buddha pujas and tevavas, language classes, Dhamma doctrine discussions, teacher meetings, and meetings to drive forward the Buddha Sasana, the Anagarika Ramaya is truly bustling with mighty women working towards their salvation and that of the world. Sadhu, sadhu. Many a time, Mahatmyas, so those are the Anagarikas, tend to the sick with the utmost care and look after those having a difficult day with advice and affection. Some Mahatmyas will lovingly rub your head when you worship them, and teachers will listen to and help solve problems with their students at any time, regardless of how busy they are. Multiple times a day, we hear, Mahatmya Dane Gattada. Have you had your arms? Gilan Pasa Valanduada. Have you had your medicines? Pin Katyutu Kalada. Have you done your merits? Ehenang Satapenna. It's time to sleep. So I'm translating these for the benefit of non-Sinhalese speaking individuals in the audience. These are clear reflections of the sisterhood the Anagarika Mahatmyas have built. With multiple mothers and sisters taking care of us and teachers guiding us, we are walking the noble path slowly but steadily and most importantly, happily. We could not have committed our lives to the Buddha Sasana nor gained all these merits and joyful moments if not for the kindness, love, and encouragement you gave us from the very first sermon exactly 2 years ago. So this was written on the second year anniversary, it seems. Since then, together we have engaged in hundreds of pinkam, earning the necessary merits to live in the Buddha Bhumi, surrounded by noble companionship and the world's greatest teachers. You have enabled mornings where we wake up with a clear goal to work towards the salvation of all beings by spreading the truth we have been so fortunate to receive, and nights where we sleep surrounded by the Mahasangha. We are grateful to each strong woman who came before us and made this a wonderful place to live a purposeful life. You enabled stress-free and meritful days. We individually transfer merits to you every day and collectively. The four of us engage in a merit transfer every Sunday with the determination that you may come to, or as close as possible to, the monastery and practice the noble path more diligently. Now you know which four we are talking about. They were with you, amongst you, and now they are with me and amongst us. See, without you, there would be no us. And without us, there would be no you. So this is that beautiful relationship that the Sambuddha Sasana will forever foster. Our Bring Family Home mission is in full swing. Watch out. And we are happy to see many of you coming to the monastery more often, and even seeking counseling while you are out of the country. We hope to see you in the Sasana very soon. We have also received permission from our teachers to meet with you whenever you are able, so please do keep us posted. We are ready to help you find the peace and freedom we have found here in any way that will help you. Now, a bit of a footnote on that. So, we of course take the safety and well-being of our Anagarika Mahatmyas as a priority. So it is always a top priority for us to ensure that those young ladies are very well looked after. And therefore we will, unless we are confident and we know that whoever they're going to meet is not going to cause them any harm, such meetings are always very limited and restricted. But their teachers have given them permission to meet with the Dharmishtha Rajagirian family whenever you are able to and want to. See? This is what you have earned. You will see why in a moment. You have truly gone above and beyond, offering every item on the list, from clothes and electrical items for our use, right down to hairpins. I never got any hairpins from you. How come they get? Right down to hairpins, enabling me to become an Anagarika. We are deeply grateful for the many offerings you continue to make towards the Arame and the Anagarika Arame, from Dane and construction to stationery and medical equipment. We hope that the merits we transfer to you will reduce the obstacles on your path to the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. You have done and continue to do so much for us. In return, our determination for you and your children is that you soon realize that Natthi me saranang anyang, what? Buddho me saranang varang. So that you too, like us, may be able to say very soon, Swagatang vatame asi, what? Mama buddhasa santike. Finally, in your children, beg your pardon. Finally, if your children come to this realization before you do, it's not I who put that there. It's there. Finally, if your children come to this realization before you do, our humble request is that you allow us to take our brothers and sisters to our Father. Let us take them home where they truly belong. Those merits will no doubt bring you closer to paradise and help you achieve the ultimate glow, the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Till we speak again, may you engage in many meritorious deeds, listen to sermons, contemplate and practice what you have learned. please stay very close to one another, to the Gateway community, and to our teacher. They are your most valuable possessions. Please use them wisely. May the Noble Triple Gem give you my mother's, father's, sisters and brothers' blessings with metta from the daughters you offered to the Uttam Sambuddha Sasane. So, there you have it. So, that is a letter with a lot of love, affection and gratitude. Handcrafted with devotion to members of the extended family. I want to share this with you because this is how, this was a letter that was actually given out to, by one of them, to one of you. And then you had the thoughtfulness to come and share it with me. And then I asked whether it would be okay for me to read this. So, now you all have it. In fact, the request was that they had written the letter, given it to one of you, and asked you to share it in the group so that you could all read it. But I thought this letter and the reason for this letter deserves far more than that. This is why I decided that it should be read out to all of you so that you understand that none of this would have been possible if you hadn't done your part to help them come forward, take that step. I remember, ladies and gentlemen, the many days that they came up here with hope in their heart, resolve, determination, and the many days when they would be stood in a queue, or maybe they'd be just running around doing some merit work, but then there would be people amongst you who would, you know, push them along and say, go talk to Swami Nahase. Go tell him that you want to become an Anagarika. I could see, you know, this, just that, your encouragement, all of that played a part. I can only give the Dhamma. People come for the Dhamma, but they don't stay for the Dhamma. They stay because they find home there. So this is all a collective achievement for all of us and an invitation for yet others to consider. Perhaps, if your lives allow you, if you have the liberty to make that jump, at least for a short time, just to experience what the sasana is like, it doesn't have to necessarily be a lifetime commitment. You know, when I was younger, I always determined to myself, at least for a short time, I want to become a monk. There might have been some amongst you who had that plan in mind, and, you know, why not? At least for a short time, see what that's like. Maybe you might stay, perhaps you might go. We don't have a temporary ordination program at the monastery. We don't do that. Ordination is for lifetime, for life. But if someone wishes to come in, experience it, and then later on decide whether it's for you or not, who's going to stop you? But before you become a monk, you have to, of course, fulfill the one-year Anagarika program. But for the Anagarikas, it's not so. We don't have a so-called probationary period before you are an Anagarika. But the Anagarika program itself has a probationary period, so it's only after the first 18 months have lapsed, you get full Anagarika status. What does that mean? It's just a formality in every other regard. Everything's the same. But this is available. Still. While the sasana is still here with us. So, credit to you for making this possible for so many people. And Guru Handra always asks me, where are the results? Now, those days it used to be very difficult to answer that question, but now I can point at them. See, results. And the fact that, you know, you keep on this journey. There are several of you who have decided to come and live close to the monastery. That shows that you are prepared to go the extra mile and keep yourself close to the Dhamma. You know, to be honest, this is not about building a community. around us. It's not about that, because we know that whatever we build will perish. Yeah? So what's the point? I, of all people, understand the futility of building something, because all sankata have an expiry date. Whatever you build, you have to maintain. And the last thing I want to do is stick around and hang around to keep maintaining things. That's not what I'm here for. I'm sick and fed up of maintaining myself, let alone a community. So it's not about gathering a follower base or bringing people together and bringing a party together. It's not about that. It's just for the sake of getting you close as possible to the source of the truth. Once your job is done, don't hang around. Go. At some point in our journey, if you go back all the way to the beginning, you were not part of anything. You were just pure energy. But then due to ignorance and due to attachment, things started to aggregate. And then you became you. Actually, nothing became you. First there was nothing. And then out of that came you. So chaos turned to order. And then out of that order became more order. But then wherever there is order, there has to be maintenance. There has to be maintenance. See, these beetle leaves, if you leave them here for another couple of days, what would happen? It would rot, right? The whole thing would go, it would wither, and it would be time to, it would start to stink, it would go off, right? There'll be all sorts, and you'll have to clear it out and then bring it back together again. So the same happens for anything. This building, although it's here and it can keep us safe, there will come a day where it's not safe to be here. To try and keep that day from coming to us anytime soon, what must they do? They've got to maintain this building. From time to time, they've got to go and check whether there are cracks in the walls, right? Plastering need doing, or any other construction work that needs to happen, and ensure that this building is solid. This is why we eat a meal, three meals, two meals, a meal every day. Because your natural nature is to go into chaos. Chaos is the natural order of the universe. Because we fail to accept that, we try to put our own order. And that order is at odds with nature's order. Do you understand that phenomenon? Nature's order is chaos. But we are not happy with chaos. We want our order. So what do? We put our own desires, our own intentions, our own plans and wills and all that, and try and make something out of nature's order, which is chaos. But nature will never let us have it our way, because nature is always bigger than us, better than us, and nature will always outlive us. So what will nature do? Whenever we bring things together, nature's like, oh, okay. Two can play that game. The moment you stop maintaining something, actually it's not the moment you stop maintaining something, nature is always tugging at it. That is why you have to constantly keep maintaining anything. Can you name one thing that does not need maintenance? Name one thing that does not need maintenance. There's only one thing. That thing does not exist. Anything that does not exist does not require maintenance. Anything that exists requires maintenance. Your bodies require maintenance. What about your hair? Why do you think I'm shaving? Because it's a hassle. Now I don't have that hassle. The hassle of maintaining. I mean, I'm... what are you talking about hair? I don't even have to maintain my eyebrows anymore. See, now we have to brush in the morning. We have to do it. All of us do it. You do, right? Good. If not, start. Why do you have to do that? Because it goes to chaos. Why do we always check our nutrients and make sure that we have a wholesome, well-balanced diet? Why is that something doctors always go on about? Because that requires, you know, that's why even stuff we don't like to eat, our mothers will make sure it's on the plate, right? your greens and your vegetables and things like that. You don't like to eat it. When you were younger, we didn't like to eat it, but our parents used to make sure that it was always there on the plate. Because without that, we would go into chaos. What's so wrong about chaos? Why don't we just allow things to go into chaos? What's wrong with chaos? Because chaos is order. It's nature's order. The reason that we can't be happy with chaos is because we have desires. Our mental desires require things to always take some kind of form. So what we do is then we bring the four great elements and bring it to create form. This is form. Energy combined in a particular order. That order was determined by a mind at one point. You might think, what mind made this? No, it's always minds that create the whole world. Whether you're talking about the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, anything you see out there, we might sometimes think that that is nature and we are us. No, we are the father of nature. Because the mind creates nature. It's mental energy that is able to bring things together. Because desire is required. That's the reason, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I'm going to go into something a little bit deep. Okay? So I want you to pay perfect attention. See, and grasp as much of this as possible. I'm going to prove to you the point that it is the mind that creates the whole universe. It's the mind that creates the whole universe. Let me explain to you why. This is a structure. And so is this. Why does it take this structure? Why does it take this shape? Why is it not something like this? Here's the handle. Why is it not something like that? Like a Trishula. Why is it like this? Because this is how someone wanted it to be. So, when this starts to fray, or the threads come out, right, or if there's a, you know, this gets damaged, what do we normally do when something's damaged? Well, we have one of two options. Either we replace, or we repair. Yeah? So what does it mean to repair? What? Pair. We repair. To pair. To pair is to bring things together. That's a pair. P-A-I-R, to pair. So we repair. Who decides how to repair? It's wherever there's the desire. So desire has a state that this has to be. Now, just think about this. If I punctured a hole in this, if I made a hole in this, is that broken? Like, duh, it's broken, Swami. Of course it's broken. You might say. Says who? Who decides that it's broken? Think carefully. Who decides that it's broken? Those who believe that this should be like this deems that that is broken. But imagine they had some fans which had holes in them, and you could, it comes in two varieties. Imagine, you see, there are ones without, like, that come like this, and others without the holes, right? So now you have two varieties. Then if you pick the one up that had the holes in them, would you go repair them after that? Because if that is what you wanted, then that requires no repairing. Let me bring you a much more familiar example. You will laugh at this, I know, but when I was much younger, trousers used to look like this. trousers used to look like this. In my teens, when I was around 12, 13, 14, 16, that sort of age, trousers start to look like this. And then they start looking like this. Actually, they were available to purchase in the stores. Now, when my grandparents used to see this on the streets, you know, they'd think that these were very poor people who used to wear these trousers. And my grandmother used to say, "Pauvane yara puta." She would feel very sorry for the people the youngsters who used to wear these trousers. And she'd say, you know, why don't we give them some money or something, you know, so that they can go and repair their trousers. But then we would laugh at her. You say, "Grandmother, Grandma Achi, you know, you're too old-fashioned. This is the new fashion." So, did this need repairing? But what about the previous prayer trousers? When I was much younger, it used to be like that. Then, if it was torn, you'd repair it. But this, you don't repair. So who decides whether something's broken or not? Exactly. It's the mind, it's the observer. It's the observer who has a desire for a certain state. So what decides whether something's broken or not is desire. What is the state of desire? I'll give you another example. Two people are in a relationship. Okay? So they're very much in love with each other. Along comes a third. So previously he only used to look this way. Only this way. But now, from time to time, he also looks this way. Okay? So, they were married. And he was very, they were both very interested in each other. I mean, they got married and the husband, wife and whatnot. And so this was a relationship, a married relationship. And they both invested their time and energy in maintaining this relationship. So it was a good relationship, it was a solid relationship. But when she came into the picture, now he no longer wanted to be with her. Now he wants to be with her. But she won't have any of it. She doesn't know about this individual. That's how it usually happens, right? You're very careful about how you answer these questions, right? You're like... You try very carefully not to criminalize yourself, don't you? So she doesn't want to have anything to do with this because she's very much in her relationship and she wants her husband for herself, right? So she doesn't know about this individual yet. But this man now wants out of this relationship and she wants to be with him as well. Then, to her and to him, something's broken. Actually, it's not made yet. That which has to be made is not broken yet, but it's not made yet. But to him, this is there. For her, this is there, this relationship. And she wants to make sure that this relationship continues and it fosters and it's there and she nurtures it. But now, to this man, something's broken. He wants to fix it. His happiness is broken because this is not who he wants to be with. So he doesn't feel complete anymore. Therefore, what he'll be doing now is to try and come out of this relationship and forge a relationship here, which is also what she would want. When he finally gets to do that and form this relationship, at that point, they're going to have to let go of this, hopefully. Hopefully they will let go of that. At that point, she might feel heartbroken. So for her, now this relationship is broken. But to him, this is how he wants it to be. Who decides whether this is a broken relationship or a good relationship? It's all to do with the desire. To this individual, now this whole setup is broken. It's bad. It's broken. Because what they wanted was this, and it's no longer there. But to the two of them, this is now good. Because this relationship is no longer there. They want this. Therefore, this is good to him, good to them, and bad for her. But if she is a feisty one, she will not stop there. She will try and do something to get her man back. And then she will try and do something to break this relationship. And repair this relationship. At that point, how is she going to feel? Heartbroken. Now, what is good? What is a good relationship? What is a bad relationship? What is the repaired relationship? What is the broken relationship? Is it objective or subjective? It's subjective. It's subjective because what is fixed and what is broken, ladies and gentlemen, depends on what your desire is. That's why I said, going back to this example, if I made a hole in here now, you would say that this is broken. But that's because that is what your desire is. Now assume you had some... let's say this was an ornament at your home. This was an ornament at your home. You collect this from Swami Nohan, say maybe he's given it as a gift to you, you know, go and put it next to the Buddha statue or whatever, right? So now with utmost devotion, you will take this from Swami Nohan, say you go and put it next to the Buddha statue. But you have a six-year-old at home. She doesn't know, or he doesn't know, that this is not a toy. So they see this new thing, new fancy thing next to the Buddha statue, and what do? They climb up on the chair, they take it, and now they decide to play with it. So what do? They cut little shapes on this, right, and make a toy out of this. The moment they're done with what they want to do, which is, let's assume they want to cut some shapes, right, some animal shapes or whatnot, and then they bring it to you and say, "See, mummy, what I've done." To which their expected response from you is appreciation, admiration, praise. Huh? But what do they get from you? Let's not talk about that. Why? Because now to you, it's broken. But to them, it was broken to begin with. It was not right. So they had to do something about it to fix it. Fixing it meant to cut shapes in this, cut holes in this. Then you tell me, ladies and gentlemen, at which point, at what state is something broken, and at what point is something fixed, something right? It's all a state of mind. Therefore, nothing in this world is broken. Nothing in this world needs repair unless there's a mind that desires that state. If I were to drop this, what would happen? It would smash. And then it would, what's the word we use? It would break into pieces. And then we would say it's broken. That is because you want this to be in this state. But when you talk about recycling, breaking something up into its into fragments is part of a recycling process. I don't know whether you can recycle these things, but let's assume that you could. Then part of that process would be to break this into small pieces and then put it into some kind of a melting pot or something and then make shapes out of it. So then it's not broken. It's part of a process. It's the making process. So how do you determine then whether something's broken? It's all what you desire. Then we have to come to a conclusion about this. We tend to have an issue with the way things are in this world only because our desires want it in a different state. And when we want something in a different state to what it is, we say that it's not right, it's broken, let's go fix it. Chances are there'll be someone else who will want it in the state that it is in right now. Therefore, now you have conflict. When two opposing desires confront, now you have conflict. That is why you have conflicts at home to conflicts on the international scale. This is what starts wars. And this is what brings domestic issues at home as well. When you have opposing desires, and that's because the mind cannot be happy with whatever state something is in. And desire is what gets in the way. If you are able to take desire out of a mind, now the mind becomes okay. The mind is now accepting. The mind is now equanimous to whatever there is. If you can get your mind to that state, ladies and gentlemen, you'll be happy with the world as it is. But when it's raining out there, you see that something's broken because you left the clothes on the clothesline. That's when it's broken. But if you have a drought season, now from time to time at the monastery we have droughts, and then we wait for it to rain. Then we want the rain. So when it's not raining, it's broken. Then the weather's broken. And then you look up at the heavens and cry, when are you going to rain? And then sometimes you might even do offerings, puja, and expect, and hope for rain, ask for rain, plead for rain, because something's broken. So the problem is this. If it was the same God up there, somewhere, half of the world are saying, let make it rain. The other half are saying, no, it's fine, keep it like that. So who does this God satisfy now? Because there's always going to be two sides to a story. Now your cars, you don't want them to break down, do you? You don't want your car to break down. But do you know the mechanic in your town? What does he wish? Every morning, you know, like when you buy a new car, you have these rituals, right? That you take this like miris and dehi and you tie a little, what do you call them? For good luck charms, yeah, you tie them to make sure that they will, you can avoid, you know, it's like a good omen, right? To avoid accidents and things like that. You think that some it's a blessing, right? That you might do every day. Do you know what the mechanic does every day before he starts work? He also has an altar at his workplace. at which he offers flowers and incense and lamps, and he wishes and prays, may as many cars break down today as possible. Oh, the gods up there, may all those cars break down, because how else can he make money? So when your car breaks to him, that's good news. But when your car is fixed to you, that's good news. So in which state must a car be? The answer is subjective. It depends on desire. For as long as you have desire, you will always have a state that something has to be in, whatever it might be, whether it's relationships. See, when this man desires that woman, now he doesn't want to be part of this, in this relationship. But let's say he finds out that she's just a cheat, and you know that's what she does for a living. Then what does she want to do? Now he realizes that he just took him for a run, right? And then he wants to be back with this. And now if at that point she's gone away and kind of abandoned him, now she'll go back and plead at her feet. Please, 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 I'm so sorry. I didn't realize what a fool I was. Please have me back, please have me back, please have me back. Now he will want to reforge that or repair that relationship. All decided by desire. See, this is the killer. It's like the puppeteer. And you're on strings. So whenever desire changes, your actions reflect that. When desire says, biryani tonight, what does this man do? What does she do? What does she do? Then you have to work towards biryani. But let's assume, you know, halfway through your biryani, you decide, no, actually chapati is better. Then you've got to put all that to a side and start fresh, because now you cannot be happy with the biryani. This has got you on a noose. It actually desires like this. This is what you are like. Can you see yourself like that? I can. It's what it's like. Half the time, ladies and gentlemen, you don't do what you really want to do or what you really need to do. You do what desire wants you to do. Not half the time. Almost all of the time. That is why later you have regrets. You know, because this changes like the weather. This is not fixed. It's not permanent. This is the effect of causes. Desire, your desire is an effect of causes. Therefore, when those causes change, the effect of desire changes. I mean, heck, you put all your whole life into developing something, constructing something, making something, and then next moment your desire changes. What do you do then? Ladies, can I ask you a question? Wait, I haven't asked the question yet. They're always like this. I haven't asked the question yet, hold on. Right? Let's say your husband, you want to make him happy. Of course you want to make him happy. And you see him on his phone, maybe Instagram or something, and he's looking at women with short hair. And you have long hair. So you see that and you think, why is he looking at women with short hair? Maybe that's what he likes. So you go in front of the mirror and you see, oh, all these years I've put into growing my hair, and you know, what are all these things you do with them? Straightening and what else? I don't remember these words anymore. That vocabulary is now out. Ironing, yes, thank you. Ironing, straightening, dyeing. You've done all this, and now years of that, and you thought that's what makes your husband happy, but now you see him on Instagram or whatever, his social media, and he's looking at girls with short hair, women with short hair. So now you decide, okay, so, you know, he's not happy, then what's the point? I'm going to go to the salon and get my hair cut. So you have your haircut, now it's his birthday, so you want to surprise him. So you come back, he comes back from work, and you go and greet him, and he says, surprise, and you had your haircut. Because you assume that that is what he wanted. And then he's shocked. He says, what have you done? He says, I cut my hair. But why? Why did you cut your hair? Don't you like it? No. Who asked you to do that? He said, but I saw you looking on the other day. What was all that about? He said, no, I was just looking at these women like how ugly they are. And who in their right mind would cut their hair like that? Was I what I was thinking? What did you do? Oh no, I thought that you just wanted short hair. So now what must she do again? You can't just grow it back like that, right? Now she has to go through all that trouble to grow her hair back again. See, when desire changes, because desire is like the weather, it changes just like that. Initially, she was happy with her long hair. That's what she desired. Then she thought her husband didn't like it. Then she wanted short hair. So now her desire changed. So she went and cut her hair. And then when her husband asked her what she'd done, now her desire changed back to long hair. Just like the weather, desire changes. People in the marketing industry, they know this. They know this. They know that if they just keep feeding you enough times, right? A lie repeated enough times becomes a truth. So what do? They just keep feeding lies. Because they know that your desire is subjective. It's conditioned. Rather than subjective, it's conditioned. It's conditioned by a multitude of causes. And so all they have to do is change those causes. So then they'll find a figure that you admire, you respect, and they will have them say, instead of them saying something to you directly, they will have them say something to you. Maybe a sports personality. Maybe someone in the showbiz industry. Right? Someone you like, someone you admire. They will have them say something that they want you to believe. And they don't even use the product. Most of the time it's like that. People will say, you know, I eat this. You actually meet them on the street and ask them what it tastes like. You're like, I don't know, I've never tried it. Some of the products that they talk about, they don't use at all. They just do it because that's what they're supposed to. It's in the contract. Some people become brand ambassadors and they don't even use the product. But people fall for it. Because desire is conditioned. Anything that exists is conditioned. If a desire exists, it's conditioned, ladies and gentlemen. That's why I asked you earlier, can you name one thing that is not conditioned? That does not require maintenance. The only thing that does not require maintenance is the one thing that does not exist. So wherever there is existence, you will have the burden of maintaining it. Therefore, there's only one state of non-burden, and that is where there is no existence. Right from your health to your wealth, to your relationships, to what's for dinner, to your home, to your car, to your children, to your spouses, to your education, anything and everything you can name, it all requires maintenance. And that is why the more you have, the more you have to maintain. Do you still have a question as to why I let go of the many things that I had to maintain and chose this simple and humble life? I used to think that if I had more, I was a happier man. And therefore, I went through life trying to acquire and hoard as much as I possibly could. The more I had, the happier I was what people taught me, what people told me. And I bought it. But later on, I realized that the more I had, the more maintenance I had to do, the more heartache, the more burden I had to carry on my shoulders. You know, that would have been okay if all those things brought happiness to you. Then it would have been worth the price. You know, I don't mind. I'm not a lazy bugger. I'm okay to invest myself and give time and energy and all that, provided that what I invest my time in gives me back some return. So I don't mind three cars if I get three times the happiness. I don't mind two houses if I got two times the happiness. I don't mind two wives. No, not wives. That would have been twice the... No. I asked you this question once ago, once or twice before, right? One child, last week's sermon I asked you this question. One child you thought was going to give you happiness. Then you brought a second one. Then I asked the mothers in this room, were you twice as happy? And no one accepted that. No one agreed. Then you went on and had a third child. Then you must be three times as happy. And the answer was no. So then that's not a source of happiness. Then what is the source of happiness? How can anything be a source of happiness? How can this be a source of happiness? How can this flower arrangement can be a source of happiness? How can this building be a source of happiness? How can your car be a source of happiness? How can a relationship be a source of happiness, ladies and gentlemen? Because all things require maintenance. All this requires effort. And that effort you don't like to put in. Let's be honest. Do you like to put in the effort of keeping this building in this condition? Do you like to put in the effort of maintaining your car? You might like to drive your car, but the effort of maintaining your car, that you don't like to do. You know, if you could somehow engineer your life and everything around it, whereby you can just get the gain but not the pain, you'd opt for that, wouldn't you? But what's the old adage? No pain, no gain. Therefore, for every modicum of gain, you have to put up with mountains of pain. And even that gain is a fallacy. That is why this existence is useless, meaningless, and essenceless. Let's talk about that gain for a second. Because, you know, some might say, well, Swami Nahansa, you say that, but, you know, despite all these efforts that I have to go through, still the gain is pleasurable, isn't it? It's joyful, it's nice when I have it in the end, you know, at the end of the day, when I put my feet up on the coffee table, have that hot chocolate, right, and watch my favorite TV program. I mean, that's just bliss. Oh, so you think. Why is it always at the end of the day? Why shall we do it at the start of the day? Putting up your feet on the coffee table, having that hot chocolate, watching your TV, why don't we shift it to the start of the day? It's not going to be as fun, is it? Why is a nice hot shower always good at the end of the day? Why is sitting in the bathtub, just, you know, relaxing yourself, why is that so enjoyable? Why is that so relaxing at the end of the day? Why is a nice cold drink good on a hot day? And why is a nice warm drink good on a cold day? And never the other way around? Think. Why is it that the longer you wait, the more pleasurable you feel when you acquire it in the end? Absence makes the heart grow fonder. You talk about these things, but it's time to apply that into your lives. You know what would make your family life more interesting? More exciting? Spend as much time away from each other. And then once a year, once every 2 years, once every 3, 4, 5 years if possible, right? Unite. Come back together. And then there will be fireworks. But will that last forever? Or no? The first day, it will be like you got married again. The second day, third day, by the fifth day, back to how it was. And it will be time You'll be saying, can't you go again? When are you flying back? This is because this is not true happiness. That's what you need to understand. True happiness can't be like that. Apply your scientific thinking. You know, you're all very educated, so why don't you apply your scientific thinking? If X gives Y, more of X should give you more of what? If X gives you Y, more of X should give you more of what? More of Y. Right? So then, if living together with someone is X and Y is happiness, how come the more and the longer you live with them, actually the less happy you feel? And it comes to a point where it just becomes a drag and the excitement of the relationship just withers away. And then you look for time for times and this, you know, that personal space. Can I just have my own time? You can have your own time, you know, then we can get back together again and all that. You know, I've given this example to you in the past. The airport is a perfect place to see this in action. Because it's a place where people unite. Sometimes, you know, husbands with their wives, wives with their husbands, parents with their children, siblings, long departed friends, they come together. And, you know, that meeting point where at the arrivals, where people hug and they embrace each other, they just can't get enough of each other. There's flowers and all sorts. The smiles and the you know, the tears of joy is what you have there. But after a while, all that washes away, withers away. Then that cannot be true happiness. We are all on the pursuit of happiness. But because this is just a very temporary, superficial happiness, we fall into the trap of thinking that this is the true happiness. And it is not. Reason for that is, this happiness comes out of a conditioned entity. It requires maintenance. It requires absence. It requires vexation and relief from it. So if you put your life through that, ladies and gentlemen, if your source of pleasure is always to go through vexation and come out of it, that's not a very fulfilling life. There is a happiness that does not depend on this. Vexation, putting yourself through pain and then to come out of it and experience again. There is a happiness that does not depend on that. Now you've been sitting here for the last, we started around 8:30, it's now 10:30. So you've been sitting here for 2 hours. Right? When you sat down, was it not comfortable? Because you just walked outside, walked up the stairs, right? And then you were walking around, then you sat down, you said, no, this is nice and comfortable. For how long? After a while you'll be asking me, Swaminarayan, when are you going to stop? Because you would want to get up, stretch your legs, right? Give yourself a bit of a break. And then the moment you get up, it'll feel comfortable. So if sitting is comfortable, how come standing is comfortable as well? And the moment you sit, you complain about having to have kept standing. And the moment you stand, you complain about the fact that you had to keep sitting. So where is that happiness? Do you see that happiness is always one step ahead of you? It's always a case of you have to relieve yourself from some kind of pain, be it physical or mental, to experience relief. Relief is what you call happiness in your world. That is just relief. So wherever there is relief, there has to be pain beforehand. That's not a good deal. I don't know why you signed up for that. Why did you sign up for that? Don't you want a fairer deal? I mean, how many years of your life have you gone through this and put yourself through this? Pleasure only at the end of relief, at the end of vexation? Christmas is always fun because You have to wait for it. What if every day was Christmas? Now, sometimes you wish for it, but be careful, if your wish came true, that would be a nightmare. What about your birthday? If every day was your birthday? You're happy when friends come around, don't you? You organize, you arrange a party, people come around, they bring you gifts, right? At least those days you used to. Maybe not so much now, but you know, you enjoy it. Generally speaking, people enjoy that. But what if they did that every day? Every day if people turned up? Then what might you say? Now you start complaining. If people, you know, even the best friend, even the best of friends, if they hung around for too long, then there comes a point where you feel, why, you know, don't they understand? Like, you know, they have overstayed their welcome. Why? You have to find the answer to this riddle and start to look for happiness elsewhere. This is not where happiness is. The Buddha's teaching is to help you discover a happiness that does not depend on these external factors and the world changing to your desires. Because that happiness is conditional. Conditioned happiness must always be maintained. That's what I'm talking about. That's why I'm talking about maintenance and having to maintain conditioned happiness. For as long as those conditions are maintained, you will experience a sense of happiness, but that is not genuine. It's not genuine happiness. It's not real happiness. It's a fake happiness. So then what is true happiness? What is unconditioned happiness? You know, here in this letter they talked about it. The Anagarika Mahatmyas were saying that they want to give you unconditional happiness. What is that unconditional happiness? Now, let me tell you what that is. If someone asks you, ladies and gentlemen, what unconditional happiness is, the very simple answer is this: there is no such thing. All this build-up and hype, and at the end he says that there is no unconditional happiness. There is no such thing called unconditional happiness. Did I just burst your bubble? There is no such thing called unconditional happiness. I'll try and explain to you, see whether you can understand what I mean by this. Because this is as profound as it gets. This is not complicated, it's subtle. It's like threading that needle. Not complicated, but it's very subtle. There is no such thing called happiness. Happiness is not a thing. I mean, of course, you know, I don't mean that it's not a physical thing. There is no such thing called happiness, ladies and gentlemen. One side of a coin exists because there is the other side. We only talk about happiness because there is suffering. Do you understand that? We only talk about happiness because there is suffering. Your minds create suffering. Because your minds create suffering, relief from that suffering, albeit temporarily, is an experience of happiness. But you take away the suffering, now what's there? If you took away the suffering, what's left? Happiness. Take away one side of the coin, what's left? The other side. Think carefully about what I'm trying to explain to you. And I thank you for this audience. Because I have not explained this in these words before. The principle is the same. But I think this is the first time I'm putting this concept in these words. So I have to thank you for that. This is all together that make this happen. this side exists because the other side does. If you took away this side, what would be left? This side. Huh? If you took away this side, what would be left? No side. So you see, this is suffering, then this is happiness. If this is suffering, I'll make it as practical as I possibly can for you. Right? You don't like the side with the leaf on. Let's assume that. Right? You don't like the side with the leaf on. So then this side is what side? Suffering side, right? Okay, so let me turn it around. Now it's the happy side. And then if I turn this back around again, now sad face. Then happy face. Sad face, happy face. So this is what happens in the world. What is the world? Always ups and downs. And life goes on, you say, right? So always turning around. Always happiness and sadness, happiness and sorrow. This is what life is like, isn't it? Isn't this life for you? Isn't this what always happens in your life? At times this side, and then you do something about it, and then it turns to the other side. But you can be guaranteed that after a while, it will turn back round again. Just as night follows day, and day follows night, these two things will always follow each other. Whenever it's in this state, you will use whatever energy you have, whatever knowledge you have, whatever money you have, whatever connections you have, friends you have, family you have, whatever is in your power, you will use to turn this around. And hopefully try and keep it that way. So this you say is order. To you this is chaos. So for you this is order. So if this is suffering, then do you not realize that this side has to be there for this side to be there? So don't wish away suffering. Do you see the irony in that? Don't wish away suffering. Welcome it into your lives. Welcome suffering into your lives so that you can then do something about it. And experience a moment of relief and enjoy some happiness. In other words, what I'm saying is, jump into the pit of fire so that you can jump back out again. Do you see how I'm mocking you? Jump into the pit of fire so that you can keep jumping out of it. Because once you're out, you can't be there and be happy forever. Because to experience that relief that came out of the freedom from the fire and the burning embers, what do you have to do again? You got to jump back into the pit and then jump back out again. So jumping up and down, this is what we call life. Then for this happiness to exist, this suffering must exist. Then, if you're not happy about suffering, let's do something and get rid of suffering. Okay. The moment you get rid of suffering, what's left? Happiness? Nothing. Nothing is left. That's why I say there is no such thing called unconditional happiness. We can call it Nibbana if you like. But Nibbana is a state of non-existence. It's not happiness. It's nothingness. Because there can never be a happiness that is not conditional. See, this happiness is conditional on the other side facing away from you. This is why you will always try and put your force to try and stop this from turning around. The moment it starts going like this, you will push it back again. Why do you do a job 9 to 5? Why do you work? Why do you work as hard as you do? Because life is always trying to turn this way, right? So if today is payday, if today is payday, finally you have managed to turn this around this way. But from today to the next payday, what happens? This is what happens. Between two paydays, this is what happens. This is about the middle of the month. Now towards the end of the month, just before payday, it's kind of like this. And then you keep turning it until payday again. You know, your happiness is just like an eclipse. It's not yours forever. It's just an eclipse. So the moment the moon moves away, out of the way, now you have the full scorching sun right in front of your eyes. What I'm trying to explain to you is this, and the objective of this explanation is this. You have always enjoyed a happiness that has come at the price of suffering. You've never known a happiness without suffering. I'm sorry to say, you've never known one. I challenge you, if you can, come and show me a happiness that does not depend on the absence of suffering. These two things have to go hand in hand. I challenge you, if you can come and show me and point at me one example, if possible, where you can have happiness but no suffering at all. Whenever you knock on the door of happiness, you must remember that on the other side you will also find suffering. Take any example, ladies and gentlemen. Now at home, in your relationships, husband-wife relationships, parents-children relationships, you will have good days and bad days. I've been there, so I know what it's like. There are always good days and bad days. The good days are made better how? How are the good days made better? When the bad days are made worse. The worse the bad days are, the better the good days are. So after a long fight, long drawn out fight, like not just those little things that you say, not that, like when you have a real, really have a go at each other, like wrestling at home, and when you have to send the children away for a couple of days because you really want to have a proper go at each other and just, get it out all of your chest, right? So many issues that you have to settle. And after that, after the fight is done, right? And then you hug each other and come into each other's embrace and go, I'm sorry. Now your eyes full of tears and you say, I love you though, you know that, right? Sentimental, yes, but still, that recovery, that recuperation, that coming back to that repair. There's nothing to be embarrassed about because this is what we've all done and this is what we all do. Nothing to be embarrassed about. The only thing you need to be embarrassed about is not the fact that you go through these things, it's the fact that you don't understand why it happens. That is the only thing to be embarrassed about. And your constant and relentless and never-ending pursuit of the same kind of happiness. I just want you to come out of that, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want you to come out of your relationships. No. Remain married. Look, if I care. I don't care. Remain married if you want, have children, do whatever. But my only concern is about your philosophy. Your philosophy of happiness is flawed. If you're constantly on the lookout for a happiness that can be permanently yours, that cannot be so, because that kind of happiness only exists in, ironically, non-existence. When you lose something and then you find it again, does that not make you happy? To experience that joy again, what must you do? Many a time I've shared with you as personal experiences of when I lost a pair of keys But you will have plenty of examples of your own. And the more expensive it is, the more precious it is, the better the joy that comes out of it, right? See? Because why is that so? You know, if you just lose a pen or something, you don't even care. You just get another pen and write. But what if it's the pen that your grandfather gave you before he passed away? Now it has much more value. It has a sentimental value. The more you value something, the more you put yourself at risk. And you think that this value is directly proportional to the happiness that you're going to get out of it. No, but that's not the direct formula. The formula is this: the more you value, the more you suffer. And the more you suffer, the more you can relieve yourself from suffering, and that is what you experience as happiness. There's a middle part that you tend to miss, that suffering part. We often think the more value it is, the more happiness we get. You see that you miss that middle part. That's not how it happens. Do you not find yourself sometimes looking for things desperately? Not, cannot remember where you put it last time you used it? Maybe it's money, maybe it's the checkbook, maybe it's your pair of keys, a bunch of keys, maybe it's your spectacles, maybe it's your, I don't know, your wedding ring or something. Maybe it's your husband, you put him somewhere, can't find him. You know, if it's a child, you're out in the shopping, right, on the streets, and your child goes missing all of a sudden. Mothers, many nods in the room. So you know, you've been there, you've done that. I mean, you know, how many times have you seen your child? Of course, you've seen your child millions of times. But the moment you see your child, after your child goes missing, and then someone brings your child up to you and says, "Is this your child?" Beta! That experience, you have to be a mother to have that experience, right? And you can't just be a mother. Your child must go missing. So if you want to experience that joy as mothers, what must you do? Have your children go missing from time to time. See, is that the happiness you want? You want this happiness. On the other side is suffering. Why do you sign up for that? Why do you stoop yourself so low? Why do you discredit your intelligence? Why do you insult your wisdom and your ability to achieve a happiness where you can simply get rid of suffering altogether? See, this happiness has to be maintained, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I'm saying. You must always push away from it turning the other way. You must always keep it like this. Because nature will always try and put chaos back into your life. And you have to keep pushing on this. Therefore, this energy must always be exerted. Aren't you tired? How many years have you been doing this? The gray hairs on your head is evidence that you've been doing this for so many years. When are you going to win? In this game, there are no victors. Only victims. So even if you get this side, don't think that you have won. That's why when people say, "We won the war." That 30-year-old long war, people say, "We won the war." No. Because it's only a matter of time. We'll be back here again. And then what will the government do? What will people who will have lost by then want to do again? Again, push this around. And bring back freedom. What freedom? What freedom? They think this is freedom. This is not freedom. Because it's just on the other side. You just don't see it. It's waiting for its turn to turn around and come back to you. True freedom is this. That's why the Buddha talks about this, the Four Noble Truths. See, what are the Four Noble Truths? Suffering. The cause of suffering. What is the cause of suffering? Not this facing you. That's not the cause of suffering. Because when you believe that this is facing you is the cause of suffering, what do you try and do? Turn it around. That is not what the Buddha said. He said attachment was the cause of suffering. Not misfortune coming your way. That is not the cause of suffering. Then he said the cessation of suffering. And then the path to cessation of suffering, the path to the cessation of the cause of suffering, to put it more precisely. Nowhere does he talk about happiness, does he? And you thought the Buddha would give you happiness. See? Suffering, cause of suffering, cessation of suffering, and the path to cessation of suffering. Where's happiness? I mean, that's a foul deal. You come to the sasana looking for happiness and there's no happiness to be found. The Buddha speaks of no happiness at all. That's because there's no such thing called happiness. All there is the presence or the absence of suffering. There is not a third thing called happiness. Please try and understand that. There is not a third state called happiness. There is only the presence or the absence of suffering. So those who claim to be happy, those who have navigated this path and reached the destination, it is not that they have somehow found this happiness that was there at the end of the tunnel or at the end of the path. It's not that it's there and we have to go and get it. It's not that. It's simply that they have ceased suffering. Suffering has been uprooted. Suffering has been terminated. And then the state where there is no suffering, that, if we want, we can choose to call happiness. But actually, it is not happiness at all. It's nothing. Give me a nod if that made sense to you. So, where is this happiness that we can go and find? In the supermarket? In some other part of the world? Shall we go traveling? Is it in the Bahamas? Or in the Maldives? In the States? Or is it in somewhere in Sri Lanka? So why do people come here? Tourists? Why do people visit our country? I mean, we are a hotspot destination for tourism, right? People come here looking for happiness. So, this story, don't let it out. Because they won't let me do the Sunday sermon again. For our economy to work, tourists must keep coming to our country, right? And we have to give them hospitality, we have to give them tourism, ecotourism, you might call it, wildlife, adventure, right? Our food, our music, our dance, and all these things. But all of that is because of what? Back home, they were like this. Isn't it? Back home, they didn't like their work. So they wanted a vacation. A holiday. They didn't like that food. They didn't like to be with their own people. They didn't like the weather. They didn't like the work. They didn't like whatever. Therefore, what did they do? They took some money, went to the tour operator, or travel operator, and said, please, can you book me on a holiday? So what did they do? They turned this around like this. Do you think if they decided to stay in Sri Lanka forever, they would enjoy it as much as they do when they come here on holiday? Would they? No. Where's the evidence to that? Or rather, who's the evidence to that? The Sri Lankans. Because what do the Sri Lankans do? They go away. they go away, because to them Sri Lanka is this. Do you see that happiness cannot be served on a plate? It's not there at the end of a flight. It's not a destination that you can go and land and be there and be happy for the rest of your life. It's not at the end of a relationship. It's not in a relationship. It's not in the fridge. It's not in a bottle. It cannot be gifted to someone wrapped in a nice wrapping paper. It's not in Unavatuna, sorry. It's not in Yala. It's not in Kandy or in Nuwalelia. It's not by the beach. It's not in Hantana. Because all of those places, there are people who live there. And what do they do? What do they do? Yeah, the people who live in Gaul, where do they go when they want a holiday? They go elsewhere. See, that's what I say, ladies and gentlemen. Therefore, everyone's trying to do something to be happy. This doing something to be happy is a broken philosophy. If you're really happy, you must be able to not do anything. If you still find yourself doing something to be happy, sorry, you're not happy yet, you still haven't discovered the philosophy of happiness. Simple as that. If you still find yourself doing something to be happy, whether it's reading a book, right, the next Harry Potter book comes out and you read it, and then you're happy. And while you're reading it, you're happy. Then you haven't discovered the philosophy of happiness. The next TV series comes out on Netflix and you're watching that and you say you're happy. No, that's not happiness. Because life torments you, you sit in front of the TV and watch it. It means you haven't discovered happiness yet. If you go and have some Chinese, or go to an Indian restaurant, or order it, or have a pizza, and that while you're doing that you're happy, that's not true happiness. If that were true, then people who make pizzas must be eating that every day, and they don't. They don't do that. I'm only saying these things because I want you to question yourself, not me. I want you to question yourself, is this how I live my life? Have I found the true philosophy of happiness? Isn't that what I was born for? To discover the true philosophy of happiness? Because after all, isn't that what I invest my entire life doing? Trying to find happiness? Isn't that why I go to work? Isn't that why I got married? Isn't that why I had children? Isn't that why I educated myself? Isn't that why I went abroad? Isn't that why I came back once I went there and realized that, no, it wasn't for me? Isn't that why you're here? Isn't that why you buy an ice cream on a hot day? And a hot coffee on a cold day? Isn't that why? Because you're looking for happiness. Isn't that why you can't wait for the next album to be released by your favorite music artist? Isn't that why you go to the art galleries? Isn't that why? Isn't that why you hope you would win the lottery? So that you can get a lot of money, so that you can try and do all these things while you still have life left. Isn't that why you're waiting to upgrade your car to the next model, to the next version, to the next make? Isn't that why you're waiting for the next iPhone? Isn't that why you're always waiting? What are you waiting for? Because you think happiness will always come to you in the next moment. Happiness is like that carrot in front of the... You say it, in front of the... thank you. Wouldn't be nice for me to say it, right? I am here, ladies and gentlemen, to talk to you and remind you that this is what's going on with your lives, and you need to come out of it somehow, not for my sake, but for your sake. I pulled the plug. And I came out of that rat race. This is not talking about me and my monastic life or being a monk. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about my life's philosophy. Not about my lifestyle. I'm talking about my life's philosophy. The day I realized that happiness does not come in these experiences, that's the day my life began. I found the true purpose of living. Until then, actually, I was dead. I was dead until then. I hadn't made proper use of my life. I was dead. I was just doing what people told me to do. That day must come to all of you. If not today, but tomorrow. The day must come to all of you where you are reborn. And you realize the purpose of life. This pursuit of happiness that you call life, you've got to rethink it. So happiness does not come at the end of the tunnel. Happiness, pure happiness, unconditional happiness does not exist. Now on hearing that, if you are utterly disappointed, then you haven't got what I've tried to explain so far. It is actually not a cause for disappointment. It's a cause for joy. The fact that you don't need to go anywhere, do anything to find happiness. I mean, that's good news. That's the best piece of news you've heard all your life. Because all this while, what have you heard? That happiness is on the other side. Greener pastures on the other side. Make effort and go and find happiness. Do this, do that, do the other and find happiness. That is why your life has always been so effortful. And you've had to put in so much time and energy and effort and all that. Always trying to turn this around. But happiness should be effortless. To be effortless, it has to be something that you don't have to work on. That is the happiness that we speak of. It's the moment you free your mind from desire. How do you free your mind from desire? First comes this understanding that I've just shared with you. You have to want to be in a state free of desire. So your first desire should be to be free of desire. If you desire to be free of desire, then now you're on the path. But people don't live their lives wanting to be free of desire. They like their desires. They just want whatever they desire to be with them. To have that. To collect that. To acquire that. That's what people want. Most people want that. But the day that you come in your lives, the day this comes into your life where you realize that actually true happiness comes when I'm free of desire, then your only desire becomes to get to a state where you're free of desire. That is the only desire. Keeping that desire, all other desires you can eradicate. You keep this desire, the desire to eradicate all other desires. This is what we call chanda. It's one of the Yiddhipada. It's a requirement for you to fulfill the noble path. Chanda, Chitta, Virya, Vimansa. These are four of those qualities that you need. This is called chanda. Chanda means your desire to be free of desire. But you can understand. You must understand it's a different kind of desire. It's not the same as all these other mundane desires. It's a very special kind of desire. So much so that it feels almost wrong to call it desire. It's not a craving. It's not a craving. It's not greed. It's a resolve to be free of desire. Here's what I want you all to be able to do to make progress on this journey. If at the end of this sermon, right, you have come through realization that true happiness will only come to you the day you are free of desire, at least if you have come to that realization, then this sermon would have been worth its effort, worth its time, worth its effort. Whether you accept it or not, that is a huge realization. That's a massive realization in itself. Because the majority of the human race does not understand this truth. That true happiness comes when all desires... People think when all desires are satisfied, that's where happiness comes. Happiness comes where there are no desires. Then I have left you with this question now. Okay, Swami Nohansa, I understand now. Happiness comes where there is no desire. So the only desire that I'm entitled to is the desire to be free of desires, right? So then you must have a question at the end of that conversation. That should be, how do we get rid of these desires? Okay, it's all good and well that we have understood that it's to be free of desires is the perfect state of mind to be happy, and that is there is no happiness per se that's out there for us to go and get. Once we have eradicated suffering, that in itself is the state of mind that we should be. That's not a so-called happiness, it's just absence of suffering. Right? So how do we get to that state? Then I have the best piece of news for you. Are you ready for it? Here's the best piece of news. This desire is also conditioned. It's not permanent. It's not fixed. It's not an entity that will never go away. It's not someone else who put it there that you have to go and pray to them. That's why this philosophy is empowering. No one put desire into your hearts. You create it. Actually, it's not you create it. It is the effect of a process. There's no you creating desire. You are not the doer. Desire happens. That does not mean that there is nothing you can do about it. What that means is, if oxygen, temperature, and fuel together create a fire, is it the fire that creates the fire? Oxygen, temperature, and fuel, you get the fire. Who's the doer in this? There's oxygen, there's temperature, there's fuel. Right? Who creates the fire? Who creates the fire? So is it oxygen who brings temperature and fuel together to create the fire? Is it temperature that brings oxygen and fuel together? Is it fuel that brings oxygen and temperature together? Or is it the fire that kind of like brings all these things together and create itself? Is it? No. This just causes, ladies and gentlemen. This is a process. This is a process. In a process, there's no doer. This doerism, there's no doer in a process. It's raining. Who's doing it? It's sunny. Who's doing it? You're aging. Who's doing it? But when I ask about you're eating, who's doing it? You have an answer to that question. You say, I'm doing it. That's the problem. These natural processes, you're happy to say that no one's doing it. It's just a process. There's a volcano erupting. Who's doing it? You learn, that's no one doing it, Swami knows. That's just a volcano. That's nature. So is nature a person? No, you'll accept that it's just the way the world works. It's just a process. It's knowing. Who's doing it? You understand that there's no one doing it. But you're breathing. Who's doing that? I say, I'm doing that. You're drinking some water. Who's doing that? I'm doing that. You're listening to this sermon. Who's doing that? You're doing it. Someone's preaching. Who's doing that? I'm preaching. See, you have an answer to these questions, don't you? This you, I, we, they, he, she, all these things, and it's, all these pronouns, they're just madness. Sorry. pronouns were brought in and introduced to a language that was created by individuals who felt a sense of self. When they felt a sense of self, they needed a way to identify this sense of self. And that's where this word I came into our language. So in every language there's a word for I. This sense of me, there's a word for that. But if you're ready for the greatest irony of all, I will share it with you. Even this me that you experience, it is also the effect of a process. There is no me, meing. Meing, I mean, if me could be a verb, and then when you are meing, when you are meing, there is no me to meing. Just like there's no one here to ignite a fire and keep the fire alive. It's just causes that lead to that. This me that you experience is also not done by an individual. There's no person doing it. There's no doer doing it, ladies and gentlemen. There's a process that keeps on making you feel that you are an individual. You should laugh at yourselves. There's a process that works inside each and every one of your minds that makes that mind feel, perceive, that there's an I here. Don't you feel that right now? Don't you feel that you are a you? Isn't that why you feel that the person next to you is another person and I am another person? That cannot be me. That's someone else. I'm sure they also feel that they are me. But their me is not my me. I am me and they are their me. Right? We are all very separate and individual me's, aren't we? But when someone says, they all refer to themselves by I and me. Funny enough, they use the same words. Which is fair because they feel the same sense of existence. This sense of self that each and every one of you feel individually is the identical sense of self that everyone feels. Oh, the irony in that, if you don't see, then you haven't seen anything. This experience of uniqueness that each of you experience is not unique at all. Do you get that? This experience of uniqueness that you feel and to which you then give a name and an address and a gender and likes and desires and all these things you attach around this sense of uniqueness, that sense of uniqueness is identical in each and every one of you. So much so, if I were able to take this lady's sense of uniqueness and put it into this lady and then bring them back to consciousness, they would not realize that I'd done anything. You would not know that I've done anything. It's that identical. Then are you so unique? If your sense of uniqueness is the same sense of uniqueness that is not only felt by humans, but also by animals, by all sentient beings, it's fake. The only thing that you think is unique is your thinking that it's unique. It's not unique. It's only your thinking that makes you believe that it's unique. It's not unique. And why is it not unique? Is one fire unique from another fire? Is one fire unique to another fire? Is it? No. Why is that? Because it's a process. When causes unite, come together to create an effect, there is nothing unique there. It's just an effect of causes. And it's the same things happening in your minds right now, ladies and gentlemen. There is nothing unique about you. All that's going on is there are minds that are being created, and in each of your minds, there's a sense of uniqueness that is generated because of the causes that are there. We call those causes ignorance and attachment. Avidya and tanha. Or ignorance and desire, if you want to call it. This is the desire for the mind to feel unique. The mind has a desire to feel unique, to feel a sense of identity. And when the mind has a desire to feel a sense of identity, it will fabricate for itself a sense of uniqueness. So actually you're busily creating ice, not ICE ice, ice. You're all busily creating these ice or me's. You're all busily creating me's right now. In each mind that is created, a sense of self is created. And the next one, a sense of self is created. And the next one, a sense of self is created. It's not happening just in you, it's happening in everyone right now. This sense of self, they're all a product of ignorance and then attachment or desire, either way. This is why, if you can free these minds from desire, to do that you have to free it from ignorance. If you can do that, where there is no ignorance, there is no attachment, there is no desire, and in that case, there is no sense of self. There will be no sense of self. The day that this happens for you, you will stop feeling that you are a you. Right now you feel that, don't you? Don't you feel that you are someone's husband, someone's wife, someone's mother, someone's daughter? It's more than just knowledge. It's more than just knowledge. It's actually an internal, kind of like an all-encompassing, you know, you are that. Don't you feel that way? Who's the owner of your body? You, right? You are the owner of your body. You feel that because ignorance is working in your mind right now. You are not the owner of your body. This is just energy. The sense of ownership. When you bought your car, you bought it from someone, right? Once you're done using it, you would sell it to somebody else, right? Do you transfer a sense of ownership as well? You didn't get the question. Okay. You buy a used car, let's just say. Okay? So you sign the paperwork, and then they transfer the car to you. You give them money, they give you a car. What about the sense of ownership that they have? Do they transfer that to you as well? Come on, think. If the sense of ownership of that car is currently with that individual, the previous owner, must they not transfer that to you as well? Because it should be transferred from person to person, right? Along with the car? Do they transfer that? No. Then how do you get a sense of ownership? Indeed. You create it in your own mind. So it doesn't come with the car. It's not in the paperwork. It's not even in the money. You create that sense of ownership in your mind. Then what is sense of ownership after all? It's just a nature of the mind. It's just a creation of the mind. If that is so about the car, then tell me about your husbands. If that is true about the car, then tell me about your wives. Tell me about your bodies then. Whose body is it? Yours. But if someone comes and touches you, what's your reaction? Hey. Why do you get offended if someone that you don't know, a stranger, touches you? See, you will let someone you know touch you. I'm just talking about, you know, simple, safe touch. Good touch, not bad touch. Huh? Just a good touch. Right? If someone touches you, provided they are in your pool of people who belong to me, my people, my family, it's okay. But if they're a stranger, you find that offensive. You find that repulsive. And you might even shout at them, tell them off, scream at them, accuse them. Because this body is whose? Mine. That body is whose? Theirs. So your son is, while your son is allowed to touch you, a stranger is not allowed to touch you. These are just bodies. Not your bodies or their bodies or his bodies or her bodies. These are just bodies. This is just mass. This is just energy. But your sense of ownership, you keep creating in your mind. And as a result of that, if someone who you call a stranger touches you, now you're offended. So much so that you might file a lawsuit against them. Can I ask you a simple question? And I'll conclude on that for today. Tell me the difference between I don't know whether I should ask this. You're like, ask, but after I ask it, you'll be like, oh, how could you ask me something like that? I'll put it in as polite a way as possible. I just want you to take the essence of this, okay? Don't think to yourself, how could Swami Nuhansi say something like this or ask us something like this. I want you to take the essence of this to understand something out of this. Okay? This is food for thought. Okay? What's the difference between rape and the same action done with consent? Physically, what's the difference? Physically, what's the difference? There's no difference. Why is it that one is okay and the other isn't? What's the difference there? Desire. So where there's desire, that is okay. Where there is no desire, that's not okay. One will get you into trouble. The other won't. Think about it. That's why I say, bring me rape victims and I will heal them. Bring me. This Dhamma is for everyone. If you know a rape victim, bring them. I don't want the person who committed the crime. If you want me to heal them, bring them as well. And I will teach them that there is no such thing called her body or his body or your body. This is just matter. This desire that was created in your mind, that was what led you to relieve from this vexation that you experienced as a pleasure, and that pleasure was not really in that physical body or in that experience. It was simply because there was a vexation in your mind. That's why the same action done with somebody else would not have triggered the same response in your mind. That's why you went after a particular person. See, think about it, folks. See, those three individuals that I drew on the board earlier. Two of them may not find any pleasure in it anymore. But the moment they experience that with a new person, now how does that become enjoyable? If all that's happening is two physical objects coming into contact with each other. It's because for one there's a desire and therefore there's a vexation. Relief from vexation brings you pleasure. Therefore, none of you can bring any pleasure to another person. It's all mind-made nonsense. Husbands cannot find it from their wives. because it's not there. And wives can't find it in their husbands because it's not there. So why do you go looking for it in another person or through that kind of relationship, through that kind of experience? Just because it's worldly, it's okay? Is that what you're going to tell me? Because we are just worldly beings. We are just prithakjanas. Therefore, it's okay? The truth is not just the truth for Aryans. The truth is the truth. How can it be one version of the truth for you and another version of the truth for Aryans? For noble ones who started walking on the noble path? For Arahants, let's say. The truth is the truth, ladies and gentlemen. What's the difference? Think about this as an example. A man, so-called, rapes a woman. Then he elopes, nothing happens. Years later, they don't see each other's faces, so they don't know who it is that they did this to and who did it to them. Years later, they meet on a bus. And then they fall in love with each other. And then they get married. Little do they know that this is the man who once raped me. No problem, right? Now the same thing happens. Between the same two individuals, it's not rape anymore. How? We have an entire court system and books and volumes of this on laws and regulations and conferences and summits and all sorts of work going on in the world out there to bring peace, harmony and justice, right? To bring justice to women who have been raped. And to bring justice to the men who have done so. It's not always man to woman, it could be the other way around as well. I'm just giving you an example. You know, while all that is going on out there, new laws come in all the time, making amendments to existing laws, sometimes even constitutional changes to make the place, this world, a safer, better place for everyone. One sermon is enough, isn't it? If only we spoke the truth. That's why I say, bring those rape victims. Bring them here. Bring them and sit them beside you. And let them hear these words. That's why I say the Dhamma heals. The truth heals. It's not about reprimand. It's not about retribution. It's not about punishment. Punishment fixes no one. Incarceration doesn't fix anyone. Prison systems, I don't know what they're doing, but it's not my place to comment on it, but I can't see how that fixes the mind because you're punishing the body. You keep a body locked in a cell and assume that 3 years later, 10 years later, 30 years later, they come out reformed. How? You went in the same drushti, you come out with the same drushti. But one sermon can fix them. Is this not therapy for the weeping heart? This is why to heal the world, we have to bring the truth, take the truth far and wide. Both to the rape victim as well as to the person who committed it. Only the Dhamma can heal. Because let's be honest, most people, once they commit the sin, and then they realize and they come to their senses, you know, now the vexation's gone. Because once the vexation's gone, the pleasure's gone. And now all they're left with is just guilt. Soul-crushing guilt. That's what they're left with. But guilt itself is the effect of ignorance. Because they continue thinking that it was I who did it. But there is no such thing called I. Take away the I, you take away guilt. Taking away guilt does not mean that they will now be free to go and commit any more sins. When there's no I, then what sin? Sin is always done to satisfy the self, take away the self. Did you know that guilt was also a sin? Guilt is also a sin. That's why we must make every effort as much as we can, ladies and gentlemen, to take the truth of this Dhamma. To teach people that this desire is conditioned. So if something's conditioned, there's no doer here. Therefore, you don't need anyone's consent to free them from suffering. Because it is not they who do it. It's done. Take away ignorance. How do you take away ignorance? By giving them wisdom. What are we doing in these sermons? Giving wisdom, the right way of thinking, right views. That's where the Noble Eightfold Path starts, with right view. Right view replaces wrong view. Wrong view is ignorance. Replace with right view, now you have wisdom. Where there's wisdom, there's no more desire. Because there is nothing to desire once you have wisdom. Therefore, when there's no desire, there's no more a sense of self. Where there is no sense of self, there is no fight for self-preservation, no self-regard, no self-guilt, no self-anything. That is freedom. So if you know someone who has been a victim of rape, I would not talk to them and say, you know, try and forgive them. There are classes for that. There are seminars and lectures and therapy and all that's there out there for that. I think we need to do more than that. I think what we should teach them is there is no one to forgive, because there was no one that was raped. It was an incident. Don't take personal ownership of that incident. Personal ownership is what personalizes suffering. And then what do people try and do? They try and forget the past, because memories keep coming back to haunt them. The only problem with memories, actually there's no problem with memories. What there is whenever memory comes, you take personal ownership of that memory. That's when it becomes a torment. It was I who did it, or it is to me it happened. Take away that me, I, take away that me, and you're free. So bring the raped and bring the rapists. Bring them. Bring the abusers and the abusees. Because they all need healing. That's your part that you have to play. In every social circle that you find yourselves in every community that you find yourselves in your family, at the workplace, if there's something you can do, ladies and gentlemen, to take this truth out to people, do it. For your sake as much as world peace, to heal hearts, to mend minds. I don't say this because I'm a monk. I don't say this because I'm a follower of the Buddha. I say it because I see no other truth. I can't see an alternative. I don't know of an alternative. If you have one, share it with me. This is the ultimate truth. So a couple of weeks back at the monastery, you know, we had a program on which we launched the truth in 27 different languages. I mentioned this last week to you. Today I have a video to show you. Many of you were there. Now I think you understand why we have to take this message out to people. Because when someone wants to rape someone, they don't discriminate by race, religion, age, right? Whenever desire strikes, they become carnal. It's not because they're bad. There are no bad people in this world. There are only good people and people waiting to become good. So we have to take this message out to people out there. And for that, we have to speak to them in their own tongue, so that it doesn't just reach their heads, but it reaches their hearts. So let me show you this video. Please rejoice in what you see. It is a call out to the whole world, an announcement that we make that we have the truth now and we wish to heal hearts and mend minds. Ready? And as you watch this video, I just have one thing to ask you. As you watch this video, ask yourself this question. Actually, ask yourself two questions. Number one, where would you be today if you hadn't heard the Dhamma? That's question number one. Okay? Where would you be today if you hadn't come across the truth, the Dhamma? Number two, now that you have it, what can you do personally to help further this mission? What can you do personally to help further this mission? I don't need bold, grand things. Not necessarily. What can you do? If it's to learn a language, maybe it's that. I'm not here to prescribe. I'm here to invite. Ask yourself two questions. Number one, where would you be if you hadn't come across the Dhamma? Number two, what can you do to help further this mission? Let's see what the mission's about. See what we can do when we come together. They will not have learned the languages, but you help them. I remember many months ago I mentioned that we were going to, at the monastery, learn these languages and take this message far and wide. From that day, I remember from the very first day, there were those among you who came up and asked, Swami Nansa, what can I do? I know these languages, can I be a teacher? And some of you are now teaching at the monastery. There were those who said, can we donate some books so that we can, our students can learn these languages? There were those who came forward and provided technology that we needed. It's all these collective efforts. No one here. That's what I've been talking about all this time. There's no one here. And we can put ourselves to a side. The whole world unites. And ourselves become far more important than anything else. Then there's war. There are battles. There's selfishness. So I asked you to think about one thing that you can do personally to help further this mission. Whatever it is that you thought of, try and do that as much as you can. For everyone's sake. Bring the rapists, both the victims and those who have committed the sin, because they both need to be healed. And we can do that. I know we can do that. You know we can do that. And that is why we so boldly invite, come. Come. Let's give them rest. I want to thank you all so very much for making all that we do possible, ladies and gentlemen. I'm beyond words, honestly. Thank you so very much for making all that we do possible. When we first arrived at the monastery many years ago, it was just a forest. There was nothing there. Only a few young men who wanted to make a difference. And from there on, started a journey of love and compassion and wisdom, with one teacher to follow and a great master who laid the truths before us. We followed with determination and resolve. I never imagined it would be this today. Back then, honestly, I never imagined we'd be doing all these things like this on this scale. If you told me that you'd be doing something like that today, I would have laughed at your face. Yet today, look at what we have been able to achieve. I take very humble pride in our collective efforts. So this is not just flattery when I say, it's together we have made this possible. And I want you to take every bit of credit. You, your teachers, your families, your friends, anyone and everyone, we have a big part to play. And there's a big mission that we have to fulfill. So, onwards and upwards. The world needs us, and we need the truth. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Let's conclude the merit transfer. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, by creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the path and to be healed of all fears and sorrows. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it on through generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery who give me noble companionship, as well as all the anagarikas and anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to those who go all the way to help and support the mission of the Sambuddha Sasana by making offerings towards the Sasana. Be that well wishes and goodwill in whatever capacity they are able to make such and offer such support to the Sambuddha Sasana, they do so in the hope that it helps them acquire merits to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Let us also transfer this message to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers, our employees, as well as anyone and everyone who helped us shaped and gone out of their way to help make a better life for all of us. May these merits be transferred to all of them. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits to devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in the blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives for the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers to us, fathers to us, brothers to us, sisters to us, siblings to us, someone to us. And in any way and every way they have helped us and supported us in any way possible, let us with a sense of gratitude towards all that they have done for us, transfer all these merits that we have acquired. May wherever they may be healed and be free from the woeful states and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahatirani Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you. Raga kinnen midetva Dvesha kinnen midetva Moha kinnen midetva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva Mamada siyalu loka Siyalu satmayo Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva
නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා රාග ගිනි නිවේවා ද්වේෂ ගිනි සත ලැබේවා නිවන් සත ලැබේවා නිවන් සත ලැබේවා
තුනුරුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බෙලෙන් සීල ලෝක සීල සත්‍යයම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා සාදු සාදු සාදු